Welcome to the October 3 episode of the Biz News Briefing. I'm Alec Hogg. We'll be returning to the R.W. Johnson interview of yesterday and adding quite a lot of updates that we had today. Don Ngobe will be featured, as will be Yusuf Kassim, who is the DA's Eastern Cape representative after some big moves for the party there on the younger, or among the younger set. Walter Aylett, a new market commentator, brought back into the fold. Goodness, I haven't spoken to Walter since I was on national radio. How many years ago? More than a dozen years ago. And then we'll find out more about Tesla's results from our partners at Bloomberg. Let's get things going with R.W. Johnson. The reason why I felt it was a good idea to bring in this clip for Biz News Briefing today is that on the R.W. Johnson interview that I did yesterday, there were many hundreds of comments on the YouTube channel, but most of them focused on one area that we didn't talk about in the Biz News Briefing, and that was the DA leadership and succession plan. So I thought it would be an idea to bring out the important part of that so that you're also informed if you haven't had the chance yet to watch the whole R.W. Johnson interview. Do remember that all of the interviews that we take clips out here, the highlights out that we share with you on the briefing, are available in full form on Biz News TV on YouTube and, of course, on Biz News Radio. That's on Spotify and iTunes. But let's pick up now with R.W.
As we know, Steen Eisen, first of all, brought in Kavanaugh, which produced enormous amount of trouble and hostility, not only within his own party, but also, of course, among the black civil servants. And it seems to have triggered a considerable amount of hostility and even sabotage from some of them, because things are not working the way they're supposed to in his department. People haven't been paid for 3 months. He can't get rid of Kavanaugh. It's all a big mess. Now, in addition, however, what he's done is he's appointed an all-white office team, some of whom have already got track records of bitter hostility towards the very civil servants they've now got to work with. This is a very foolish thing to have done, but he doesn't seem to have thought about it. And the result seems to be that his ministry must be in a chaotic state. It's not surprising that, you know, Macpherson and Schreiber are able to roll out already that they've done this and done that and making progress, and there's no such signs from the Minister of Agriculture. So I think that, you know, he's made some very clumsy mistakes.
Not for the first time.
No, well, look, you know, I think another oddity is that the people that he's appointed are all people who now he has to ask for special dispensation, because like him, they only have matric certificates and they're supposed to have higher qualifications than that for the post they're in. And it seems to be a Steen Eisen tick that he's very conscious of his own educational lack of qualification relatively, and he seems to prefer to appoint other people with the same. But it's only producing more problems.
What does this mean if you look ahead to the leadership of the Democratic Alliance? It does appear as though Steen Eisen has got some very strong ticks. He, for instance, went and got a second-hand Prado to try and show that he wasn't a spendthrift. But on the other hand, his leadership of his own department, if that's not going so well, that can't stand him in terribly good stead when there are others who could stand up to become the next leader of the Democratic Alliance.
Yeah, well, look, it's no secret that Jordan Hill Lewis would be very much the preferred candidate, including against Steen Eisen. I don't think there's any doubt. You just talk to any normal ANC activists or MPs, and that's what you get. I think it would be very unwise of Jordan Hill Lewis to go for the leadership. He's much too young. He's only started a few years ago at Cape Town. He's got an awful lot of that job still to do. It's a job that he loves and that he's very good at, whereas being leader of the DA is a very difficult job, not a particularly pleasant one, and for classically South African reasons, because the DA is by far the most multiracial party. And that means that the leader has got to be continuously sensitive to all the different communities represented by that party. It's relatively easy to be an ANC leader. I mean, you've just got to keep black people happy, and that's how they talk about our people, as they talk. But a DA leader has got... I mean, you could see how disastrous it was that Muzi Maimane clearly had sort of inherited ANC notions about Afrikaans-speaking people and was very dismissive of them and their interests. And this quickly rebounded on, and he lost an enormous number of Afrikaner votes at the 2019 election, which cost him his job.
Well, if you go and have a look at the YouTube video and the comments underneath it, and we're talking here particularly about the R.W. Johnson interview, you'll see that there's a lot of focus on John Steenhuisen, and I would say probably 80-20 anti-Steenhuisen as the leader of the Democratic Alliance. I was trying to make the point that his second-hand Prado was, in terms of the ministerial guidelines, he could have got himself a really fancy car, but he's trying to send a message or a signal that governance, good governance, doesn't mean taking taxpayers' money to the maximum. There is two sides to this story, of course, but we're in the middle here. R.W. Johnson will be telling you what he believes from his many, many years as a political scientist, 26 of them teaching the subject at the Oxford University in the UK. And amongst his students are numerous members of the cabinet in the UK and elsewhere in the world, and including a number of prime ministers as well. So when he tells you that he thinks this or thinks that about a local politician, I can assure you it's not a personal thing. It's really coming from his position, which is one of total independence. Another story that we have been covering over the last little while is the goings-on at the Stellenbosch University's Vilgenhoek residence. And recently, in an interview, we were warned that an organization that calls itself the Association of the Advancement of Vilgenhoek Residents would be taking on the University Council to the High Court. And it's duly done that. It filed an application today to stop the university from closing Vilgenhoek for the next academic year. It argues that the closure is irrational and says would cause irreparable harm to students, and has given a lot of affidavits and psychologists' reports. This is a story that isn't going away, even though the council hopes, or would be hoping, that it would do so. While we're talking about universities and the Democratic Alliance, well, up until recently, the EFF seemed to have student politics well covered. And this week, there was a big change. The Democratic Alliance in the Eastern Cape had an incredible performance in the student elections there. It went from 22% to 77% of the Student Representative Council seats. The EFF going the other way. It had the majority in the past. My colleague Chris Stain spoke to Yusuf Kasim, who's the DA's head or provincial chair in the Eastern Cape, on what was going on.
We're very proud of the students of Nelson Mandela University for standing together, Chris, and to for ushering in an era of good governance and of change at that institution, and of stability, which is really, really important. We've seen our institutions of higher learning come under increased pressure from radical student movements that have sought to hold students at large hostage. And we believe that this result at Nelson Mandela University bodes well. The DA Students Organization won 79% of all SRC seats that were available in that election. So it is indeed a landslide victory. They also won most of the campuses, bar one of the campuses. So four out of the five campuses were won by Dasso. They won most of the faculties and, in fact, just shy of all of the Opidani seats as well. So it was a sweeping victory. This was an institution that was previously governed by the EFF Student Command. We've upped our representation at that institution from 22% of the seats last year to 79% of the seats in this election that has just taken place. So, I mean, there's a mixed bag of results. The EFF does invest quite significantly in these student structures. And we've started to do the same as the DA. So the EFF's focus has been on the student niche market. I think quite interestingly, one would need to understand that not all students vote in these SRC elections. So even where the EFF has been successful, it's been on a very low poll, and where a very limited number of students, what we call the loud minority, has outmuscled the silent majority on campuses. So that's starting to change. We've turned the corner at Nelson Mandela University. We believe this is one of many dominoes that are going to fall across the country. And over the next coming election cycle, we expect to start reclaiming space.
So whatever you might think of John Steenhuisen, his party is certainly on the up and up. We see in by-elections as well that the DA seems to be just growing to almost impossible shares of the vote in certain areas. Recently, they pulled in a couple of wards with more than 98% of the vote. Extraordinary. Well, back onto business now, and the country's leading real estate residential property operation, that's Baldwin, today released a rather depressing trading statement. It said that profits for the 6 months to end August would drop by more than half. Baldwin said residential property has been under pressure due to high interest rates, and despite macroeconomic conditions improving with the announcement of the Government of National Unity, that has not yet gone through to greater purchases of apartments, which is what they specialize in. It does, however, expect that the recent 25 basis point cut in South African interest rates will help to support a market recovery. In the 6 months, Baldwin sold 640 units. That compares with 834 in the same period a year ago. But the good news for shareholders is that it has a forward sale of 743 units, so halfway between last year and this year for the second 6 months, and there's still a long way to go on that side. Don Ndobe is a very well-known entrepreneur in South Africa. He's one of the pioneers of the what were then called the Black Chips, a company called Real Africa Holdings. He built it into a multi-billion rand organization when it got to a point that he felt it had fulfilled a lot of its potential. It was then liquidated, and around 3 billion rand, and you're going back a couple of decades here, was distributed to shareholders in Real Africa Holdings. And it's interesting to know, would be interesting to know exactly how those who were empowered and got all of that lovely lolly applied it and indeed built their own businesses from it. But Don didn't retire. He, by the way, was the first black director of Anglo American. He got busy on looking for gas in South Africa and has spent the last two decades picking up licenses, finding where gas is, meeting with farmers in outlying areas. And this after hitting the mother lode in a part of the world that I know particularly well, just to the north of where I grew up. He spoke about it at the BizNews Investment Conference. And here's the highlights of that talk, the gas discovery that the company that Don is a director of now, he's collapsed his shareholding. It's called Kinetico Energy, listed in Australia, hasn't been listed in South Africa yet because Don tells us the South African investors don't kind of get the story, whereas the Australians certainly do. And Kinetico was added into the BizNews web trader portfolio over the last 3 months, and it seems to be raising its head a little. Certainly when you listen to Don, you understand why this is a company that is well worth considering if you're a long-term investor. Let's listen in.
By 2013, we had about 23 core holes and we had about 9 permeability test wells. But bear in mind, when we do this drilling, we're doing this without any fracking. We are not blasting. We're not putting chemicals. We're not blasting Mother Earth. No. It's like actually when in your garden you're looking for water. There was no flaring. And of course, one of the problems in South Africa is that when you start talking about gas, people don't start thinking that you're going to blast, you're going to fracture. We don't actually fracture because we found gas in shallow deposits that are not deep. So by 2013, we had 23 core holes and 9 permeability test wells. And we did this without any type of flaring. And then when we took this to analyze this, and we then told, and I think this was Gustafson and Associates, who said that we think, Don, you've got gas in place, GIP, of 2.4 trillion cubic feet. 2.4 trillion cubic feet. We then said, well, who else has done this? And then, of course, there is somebody else who did this, and that was Mos Gas. But Mos Gas was built on less than 1 trillion cubic feet. And now we're being told here that we're sitting on 2.4. The gas deposits are found in sand. Sandstones are found in the seams, in the dolerite that trapped there. And then, of course, we then went and concentrated on Amersfoort. In Amersfoort, we had one hole we drilled for 7 months. And in that hole, we found something like 26 million standard cubic feet of pure methane, 7 months. Pure methane because there were no impurities in that. In fact, the guy from Arizona, who was our drilling engineer, Mike Dahl, he used to call me and say, Don, come and listen. And I said, Mike, what's this? He said to me, Don, what we have found here is a big hole, and he nicknamed it the Beast. We then drilled another 500 meters. We found another hole, and I said, Mike, what's this one? He said, this is the Son of the Beast. And then we'll go another kilometer, 1 kilometer in Amersfoort. We drilled another hole, hole number 6. I said, Mike, what's this? He said, this is Amazing Grace. I then go another 2 kilometers drilled in Amersfoort, hole number 10, which is one of my favorite holes, which was owned by a farmer who was a medical doctor, Daniel van Dijk, and I find something big. And Mike called me, said, Don, come and listen. And I listened, and I could hear this thunder, like a jet coming. And I said, Michael, is this the Beast? And Mike said, no, Don, this is Godzilla. Actually, on the holes that we drilled, we found that there was natural gas.
It's an extraordinary story. When you start looking into Kinetico and the focus that they have on the Mpumalanga, southern Mpumalanga province, right near the KZN border, you'll get a better understanding. And what Don Ngobe was telling us was that they have reserves there which are 2.5 times the size of Mos Gas, and there's no fracking involved. So there's no environmental lobby that'll stop them from extracting the gas. Overlay that with the fact that Sasol is running out of gas from its fields in southern Mozambique, and there's a heck of a story. How did I find out about this? Well, James Lorimer, who's the Shadow Minister of Mining in the Democratic Alliance, at one of our conferences started talking about the oil and gas potential of South Africa, and he said he has one share in his portfolio, a single share, and that's Kinetico. It's in our portfolio too. On the Stock Exchange News Service today, South African retailing group SPAR, which has had its ups and downs in recent years, announced that its long-term chief financial officer, 58-year-old Mark Godfrey, will be replaced by 56-year-old Muhammad Isaacs, who's formerly of Woolworths. Godfrey has been SPAR's FD since 2010, while Isaacs held the same post at Woolworths from 2013 to 2023. So it looks like they're just swapping chairs, really. Isaacs is also the chair of the University of Cape Town's Finance Committee. He qualified as a chartered accountant through EY. He joins SPAR next month. SPAR's share price has recovered a little over the last 12 months, but it's still down by a third in the past 12 years. So Mr. Isaacs is going to be keeping score and hoping that that gets reversed in the 5 years ahead. Today we introduce a market commentator who I did a lot of work with when starting Business Radio in South Africa in the late 1990s and right through to the noughties and early after 2010. Walter Aylett has an incredible track record. He started his own business, Aylett & Co., about 20 years ago now, and he's a very strong follower of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. So the right guy to be talking to when you're wanting to understand South African investment opportunities. I asked him to tell us a little more about his view on Capitec. Now, it's an unusual share for a person like Walter Aylett to look at because Walter's one of those value investors, and Capitec is a high-growth company that always seems to be expensive. He told us about his Capitec thoughts, but then went into another business that you might find very interesting, which he says could be the next Capitec. Let's join Walter Aylett. Over the next 20 years, do you want to be in Capitec?
You know, what a great company. And it's, you know, you talk about mistakes. It's really errors of omission that kill us fund managers. Not so, the bad ones are errors of commission, and we don't really commit to those. But there's a wonderful, wonderful story of a great business. You know, I met the CFO of Bank of America, who is a South African. I went to see him in New York, and all he could do was ask me about Capitec, and that was about 5 years ago. And the respect that it commanded for him. And I think it's a good example that even in your own back garden, you can find a brilliant investment. And they've got no legacy that the big banks have. And the danger is that they will create a legacy. We've seen in the life assurance businesses with Discovery, where their competitors had a lot of legacies. But I can't say anything bad about Capitec other than it's in the price, you know. And I'm not, I think it's easier to, you know, to buy some other stocks. Like, for example, we're very big in We Buy Cars. I think that could be the next Capitec in this country. The only thing that's going to hold back We Buy Cars is that we don't buy cars. In other words, it's a 500,000 car market per year, brand new car market, and that the consumer doesn't get richer. But, you know, there are these successes, and I think Capitec's one of them. It's a great company, great experience, easy to understand.
I'm curious about We Buy Cars. I know the players there quite well. In fact, Farn and Dirk are going to be presenting at our BizNews conference next year as an example of entrepreneurship. Yeah. But for you to give them the thumbs up is quite applauded. What is it about them that excites you?
Well, we stumbled onto it by chance. We were very big in transaction capital, and we did really, really well. We bought it when Mr. Lamberti left it, and we rode all the way up to 50 Rand. And one of the investment transaction capital was We Buy Cars. Unfortunately for us, they were a leveraged business, and SA Taxi was one of the other businesses in transaction capital. I mean, you know the story there. We should have probably lightened, and it's always this debate, do you sell your roses or do you pull the roses out and leave the weeds behind? Nevertheless, we got to understand We Buy Cars, and we spent a lot of time with them, probably 2 years before we invested, when they were unlisted. And, you know, it was at a time when South Africa was probably at its real low, and the listing was forced upon them. I don't think they wanted to list at that time in as transaction capital. So we bought as much as we could. I think we own more than 5% of We Buy Cars today. It was just ridiculously cheap, and we could not get enough. And we're not that big in terms of the other asset managers.
But we did pretty well in getting our stock that we wanted. And we thought 23 Rand was the right price to buy it. And we got offered at 1875. That was a very, very good price. And then I think looking forward, if they can achieve what I think they want to achieve, which is to try to get us to sell our cars more than once a year, it's a total different business then. It's not a distributor or a dealership. Can you imagine going every year and just changing a car? I just sold a car to them now. It was the most awesome experience. And I tried their competitors. It was abysmal. I am speaking to my book, I guess, but I did try and sell through their competitors, and it was terrible. Whereas the professionalism is there and the ease. And I think, you know, there are always going to be difficulties and challenges in that industry. Buying a car that's 7 or 8 years old from them will come with problems, and there's always reputational risk that we think about, and they will be the player in the market and they will attract negative attention as well. So we've got to be careful here.
Walter Aylett talking about Capitec, whose results were released earlier this week. We have a interview with the chief executive, Gerry Fourie. That's on the various BizNews channels. And We Buy Cars, which today opened a new store in Rustenburg. So Faan and Dirk van der Walt certainly aren't slowing down now that they own the company or have extricated it from Transaction Capital and listed it on the stock market. Walter was talking about getting the shares at 1875. He was prepared to pay 23 Rand, and that was ahead of listing. Share price is now 30 Rand a share, but he certainly is not selling his shares. And I guess if you were one of those who had bought into that, as he was describing it, it's a rose, stick with it. Well, still with a company and a South African entrepreneur, well, we like to call him that. Elon Musk did leave here as a 17-year-old, so I guess he might have learned some of his entrepreneurial talents outside of the country. Well, you read his biography, he and his cousins were pretty going hard at it when they were still at school in Pretoria. But today, we are reflecting on Tesla's production figures that were released last night. They revealed a slowdown in growth at the company, raising concerns amongst investors about its demand and supply equations. The company reported producing just over 430,000 vehicles. That was for the September quarter, in other words, the 3 months to the end of September. And that's down from about 480,000 units a year before. So a 50,000 decline in the number of units. This is the thing that Wall Street has been obsessing about. Key issues related to production challenges at its Berlin and Texas gigafactories and difficulties, Tesla said, in sourcing key components. Also an issue was that price cuts are cutting back on the profit margins at the company. The share price lost a cumulative 5% on those results. But the real big thing comes later in the next week when Elon Musk will unveil his grand plan for robo-taxis. And as we hear from Bloomberg's Craig Trudell, and who assesses the Tesla figures, together with his colleagues Caroline Hyde and Ed Ludlow, those retail investors who've kept the Tesla share price running are waiting for robo-taxis rather than the oddities of the quarter-by-quarter production figures.
Yeah, I think this is a case of, you know, a narrow beat giveth and a narrow miss taketh away. This is a company that, you know, its shares are known to be quite volatile. Just a quarter ago, they just barely exceeded expectations and the stock went kind of crazy. I don't think we necessarily learn a ton from these numbers. I think, you know, we do generally see a nice upward trend both sequentially and year over year. Having said that, if you kind of, you know, pan out a little bit and look at the trend, you know, going a little further back, we really just see a sort of general kind of flattening and lack of growth from this company. On a year-to-date basis, we may actually see a decline if trends hold up. We've seen them drop a little over 2% for the year. So this is a company that, you know, is priced as a growth stock that is having trouble growing.
And particularly in China, Craig.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the expectations going into these numbers was that this company was going to get a big boost from China increasing subsidies for people to trade in older cars and get an electric vehicle. We did see Tesla's wholesale numbers tick up as a result of that boosted incentive. But, you know, those numbers also are wholesales. That means, you know, they're kind of closer to shipments as opposed to actual, you know, vehicle deliveries. And so, you know, we may actually see some of that, you know, support coming into play in the fourth quarter of this year.
As always, you go straight to social media. I posted the numbers there, and there's this big body of people that say the sell side doesn't know what it's talking about. This isn't about delivering EVs. It's about a future where Tesla owns and operates a proprietary ride-hailing app, Craig. They run and operate robo-taxis. And I think next week we will find out whether or not that's true.
Yeah, I think, you know, the counter to that argument would, of course, just be that this is also a company that's talked about, you know, putting self-driving cars on the road and offering a, you know, a service that would be sort of Uber-like, where you could hail one of their self-driving cars for years now. I mean, it's been a half decade at least since Elon Musk was openly musing about this. So, you know, whether or not they're actually able to deliver that is another question. I do think that, you know, if they're able to execute and sort of do what others haven't, you know, pulled off, which is really do this at scale, of course, that would be massive for this company. But it's already a pretty massive valuation for you know, a manufacturer that is really struggling to increase sales.
Well, that report on Tesla brings us to the end of the BizNews briefing for this week. Our colleague Bronwyn Nielsen will be looking after you on Monday and Tuesday next week. I'll be back again on Wednesday. Until then, cheerio.